On August 24th through the 26th, grassroots media makers, organizers, and community members converged to participate in a weekend of Skillshares called the Portland Grassroots Media Camp. Tonight on Circle A Radio, you'll hear from media camp organizers, instructors, and participants. You'll also hear a sampling of audio produced during media camp workshops and events, and find out how you can get involved in grassroots media in Portland. Stay tuned for Circle A Radio. In our first interview, some of the organizers of the Grassroots Media Camp reflect on their experiences. I wanted to start off by having people go around and introduce themselves.
This is Dave King.
I'm Amelia Cates.
I'm David Myers.
I'm Tim Rice.
Patrick Engstrom-Poor.
I am Alfredo Fuentes.
Trillium Shannon.
Tony Tabora Roberts.
So how did the Grassroots Media Camp come about?
Some of us are involved in an organization called the Bolivarian Media Exchange. And we started realizing that we had folks in our group that wanted to get some skills. And so we were like, why don't we try this new method of skill shares where, you know, everybody is kind of on an equal playing field and people are being taught hands-on skills. And we realized that we are too small of a group and there are a lot of people in Portland that are media resources and a lot of organizations that are doing different classes and skill shares around media work. And so we wanted to start collaborating with other people and bring other people in to making something that was much more diverse and covered a huge range of skills, but still really focusing on the idea of getting people skills. And because strategically, we feel like, you know, everybody has a story to tell, but unfortunately, like, mainstream media is making it so that those stories aren't being heard, you know? And if we can get everybody in the community the skills to tell their own stories, what an amazing, diverse, like, breadth of media we would have.
How it came to fruition was a short road in one way, because we only had about 3 months from the time we called a more public meeting to the time the media camp happened. But it was also, you know, a long process with a lot of meetings and quite a number of organizations involved.
I'll talk about a few of those organizations. A lot of us who were early on involved were part of the radio community. We were really excited to try to bring on people who are from other parts of media, or even things that aren't necessarily the first top of mind things you think of when you think of media. Along with asking organizations like KABU and Portland Community Media and local alternative papers, we also asked community organizations. Like, we had the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines. They did a workshop on how to write a press release because they're very experienced doing that. And so really accessing individuals in the community who weren't necessarily experts, but really wanted to share skills so that all of us can do a better job of the work that we're already doing.
What were your goals for the media camp when you started, and how did that turn out?
Well, part of the goal was to incorporate immigrant communities into this process of alternative media making, because there's lots of alternative media making conferences and tools like indie media that aren't really being used by people outside of kind of the white subculture of like media activists. So probably one of the two main goals was to get immigrant populations involved in making that happen. And we did that pretty well. It kind of came together at the last minute. We didn't know if it was coming together, but it did come together very well. And I think it came to fruition, the goal that we set out to do in that aspect.
When I became aware of the media camp, I was very excited about the idea of bringing people from all sorts of media organizations or just people that had a story to tell about what's going on in their communities to start crafting their own narrative for what is important to them, because as I think all of us here in this room understand, corporate media is getting more and more restrictive about the storyline that it puts out, which oftentimes has absolutely nothing to do with real people in real communities. So that's what got me excited about this.
I saw in this project, in the beginning, I don't really believe in this project, but in the process, I start to believe, because I got a lot of people who want to learn a lot of things. And one of the goals now is keeping going, keep doing this thing, because for me it was a great experience to know new people, and they made me feel like that I know something. I saw some people, they don't know how to use the computer, and I knew I know how to use the computer, and I knew how to use some softwares, and they don't know how to use it. That makes me feel privileged, but at the same time it makes me feel sad because people, community, immigrant people, they don't have the opportunity to go to a school in their country, and they come here and they want to learn it, and that's made me feel like, well, this has to happen one more time and two more times, and the many times that we need to reach those people and make the people involved in the media's process.
One of the goals, perhaps, is a way to try to figure out how to do community organizing that is more integrated with the needs of people in communities. A lot of community organizing, so-called, that I observe is usually issue-based, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it turns out that through this process, it seems like doing community organizing around delivery of needs and services, sort of going back to a lot of the radical 60s movements like the Kensington Welfare Union, which did community organizing through the delivery of food and services to people, rather than keeping that something separate from that's delivered to you by some agency, but actually doing our connection in our communities by giving people something that they really want and need. The B Media group for the last year has been doing film showings over at Liberty Hall, and we discovered that that was a really interesting way to do community organizing too. Not only were we just showing movies, we're also educating people about the struggles going on in Latin America and connecting English-speaking folks in this community with Spanish-speaking folks in this community, and really creating a space where the community could come together around an issue rather than to throw up the issue as the reason for the people to actually get together.
I think that in some ways we reached a goal of involving many of people from immigrant communities, but more so in the Spanish-speaking community. And I think a big part of that is because several of the committed group members have been doing that work. And I think we fell short in other communities because we haven't been doing that long-term organizing as much. Although the more people we involved, the more contacts we had in all sorts of communities. So I think for us too, it was just a huge learning experience. Not only were we offering classes that people could learn media, but we were learning how it is you put together a weekend of Skillshares. We were learning a lot of lessons that we would like to incorporate.
What were some of the most exciting and inspiring things, and maybe unexpected things, that happened over the weekend for y'all?
I was stationed at PCC's Multicultural Lab for the first day of the workshops, and Polo Catalani from The Asian Reporter came and did a workshop on media strategies. And to be honest, when he said, that's what he wanted to do, I was like, okay, what is that really going to be like? But people just came out of that workshop so inspired and invigorated with how they were going to move forward with their projects and really strategizing media around activism. And so I was just thrilled that I think there were just so many moments like that throughout the weekend of like, wow, what a delight. Who knew what that was really going to be about? But it was great.
I was really impressed by, a lot of the people that have made themselves involved, including everybody in this room, with this project. And, the understanding that there's a real committed group of people that appears to be growing here in Portland that really wants to get these skills shared with others and get this idea into our communities that people can do their own media, create their own media, get it out there and do it themselves, and they don't have to wait for any media organization or anybody else to come along and tell their story.
I was impressed more by the organizing. I was around the edges of the organizing going on, and the team of people that put it together really, really were pretty impressive.
And what were some of the challenges with the organizing and or the event itself?
Well, one thing I would say was a challenge.
There were no challenges.
Strike you down, man. Well, no, I think one of the challenges and the blessings was the fact that there were so many people involved. But what was really amazing in terms of a challenge was that people would sign up and say, I'm going to do this thing. And we really wouldn't hear from them for a long time. And then they would do it. And it was pretty amazing that it all came together. But it was challenging in that way, too, that, you know, there's always more work to be done. And just logistics of having, like, 6 venues, or I don't even know the exact number. And
8.
8 venues and, like, you know, so many classes, so many facilitators to organize. I think it was really a big skill share for ourselves as organizers on how to actually put on an event of this magnitude. And, you know, in a way, we were kind of crazy to even try, but we pulled it off somehow.
Just for some stats, we had, I think, 50 workshops that went off. 12 of those were in Spanish. There's 2 or 3 that were bilingual. We think there is around 150 people, and we had 8 or 9 venues that it was taking place at.
Registration was challenging, and I think we learned a lot of lessons, but one thing I wanted to mention was that some of that was challenging, too, because Alfredo here was our Latino organizer, and he made a connection with someone at the consulate. Is that correct, yeah. Alfredo? Who ended up getting an ad, a repeating ad on Univision, the big corporate station. And so the telephone lines, I was alone in the office plugging away at a computer, the telephone lines were flooded with calls in Spanish. And so for someone like me, sometimes I had to listen to calls over and over to get the number right, or spend about half an hour on the phone with someone. But Alfredo came in and he could handle those calls in 5 minutes each or something and sign people up for classes. But it was both wonderful and really challenging.
And I think Trillian mentioned this before. I think it was a challenge too in terms of us wanting to really reach out to immigrant communities. And we weren't that successful, I think, in reaching some other immigrant communities, you know, particularly from Asian and African countries. And I would love to see us improve that. And I think we have definitely made some good connections that we can build on for the next time. And also the learnings that we have logistically in doing, you know, translation for people for other languages, and really being able to promote that as an opportunity for people so they don't feel fearful that it would be too difficult with a language barrier. So.
We should give a shout out to the Asian Reporter, though, because they did give us a free ad space in their newspaper. And right away after that ad went in, we got calls from people in the Asian community and beyond. So that was really cool. And another example of how our alternative press pulled together to promote the media camp.
None of us had ever done anything like this. We had seen conferences and how they're put together. We kind of had some kind of idea as to what you do, like, you have registration, you rent, or in our case, get for free space. But we kind of had to feel it out. We didn't know exactly how the process was going to unfold and what elements it was going to take up to get these things done. And it ended up being days after days of meeting all the same people coming together and doing different tasks as different groups, working groups, but the same people. And yeah, we learned that we need more people to do that stuff in the future.
So what are your ideas and hopes about where this will go next?
Well, one interesting thing is the weekend we did it was this incredibly busy weekend in Portland. And even still, we got a great turnout. So, and this is kind of crazy to think, but I've been pushing for us to try to do it again in the winter time, because I think it, you know, it's a little crazy, but I think just also timing the workshops and the camp at this at a time where it's conducive for more, even more people to come, I think we could be really successful.
I think one of the things we're looking at is having a centralized space. I think the idea of having decentralized spaces is a really neat idea, but in reality, it was really difficult and challenging. And it kind of, the camp lacked a little bit of cohesion because of it.
Why did you choose to go with multiple locations this time?
We actually didn't have any place for it to happen. When we first started talking about it, we didn't really know that it would come out to be that many facilitators, that many classes, and that many people involved. So it was more like, well, we want to do some radio stuff. We can do that at KBOO. We want to do some video stuff. Let's do it at PCM. And that was a way to get all, you know, get all those organizations involved.
And part of how it came about was We wanted to introduce people in different organizations and media outlets to community spaces. So, for example, some folks found themselves in the Center for Intercultural Organizing for the first time, and they have a beautiful space, a meeting space. It's not incredibly large. Most of the things that took place there were about 15 people, but they have a multimedia system there that's out of this world where you can project film, and it's a really comfortable space, and they're doing incredible organizing out of that space. So I found someone from Comité Latino, a subcommittee of PCASC, saying to me, "Why haven't I been here before?" And that's exactly the kind of reaction we were hoping to get.
Well, I would like to say something that is very excited is that when just a few people do something together, they can change a lot of things. They can change the quality of life of the people, because the people will be available to know how to use the media. But it's wonderful when you have just a few people doing something, how they can affect the life of other people. And that's wonderful, because when we do something positive with a community, even if they are immigrant, even if they are any kind of community, and we can have a peaceful world, a peaceful life, and we can have a wonderful world.
You're listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM. We've been talking with some of the organizers of the Portland Grassroots Media Camp, which happened here at the end of August. Now we'll listen to some of the audio that was produced at the camp. Lee's first pieces were produced in a workshop called Out on the Streets. Participants learned to use recording equipment, discussed what makes engaging questions, and conducted short interviews on the streets near KBOO. Later, participants edited the interviews in a digital editing workshop.
What's your favorite thing about Portland?
I like the rain.
You like the rain?
Yeah, I miss the rain. Yeah.
Why do you like the rain?
I'm from Florida. It's usually very like stormy and violent there. Here it's more calm and placid, but I like it. It's romantic.
Happy hour.
Thank you.
It's really the people.
It's kind of like San Francisco, you know, a long time ago. It's not quite so corporate. You know, San Francisco is really no longer a place that people can move to easily, and Portland is still a place that can happen. It still has that kind of funky hippie kind of thing can still happen here.
The bus system.
Yes.
I absolutely love it.
Thank you. Great.
For Grassroots Media Camp, this is Juliet.
This is Kelly.
What do you feel about the recent boom in Portland construction projects?
Well, I live in Southwest Portland, where like crazy developments are going in all the time, and I don't think it's a good idea. It's just too much traffic on the roads, and it's just too many people.
Yo pienso que es un progreso para el estado de Oregon. Es un buen progreso, más trabajo, más sociedad. Pienso que más negocios, apartamentos para la gente que quiere vivir aquí en Portland.
I think it's a progress for the state of Oregon. There's going to be more work, more society. I also think that more businesses and apartments for all the people who wants to live here in Portland.
Growth always happens with larger cities, and there's a lot of people coming in here. But I think it's being done not completely right. I think a lot of high-rise structures we put into neighborhoods that were never really planned for that type of thing. I think they need to maybe rethink location.
For Grassroots Media Camp, this has been Michael Lucton.
This is Jonathan.
Este es Dago.
This is Jay.
This next piece was produced in a podcasting workshop.
Hi, my name is Rob Los Ricos. I'm coming to you today from the Grassroots Media Camp. And we are having a podcasting workshop here at the Independent Publishing Resource Center located at 917 Southwest Oak Street, Suite 218, a resource center for people interested in making zines. We also have all kinds of computer equipment for people who like to produce and publish media projects, and you should come by and check them out sometime. With me today is Marlena Gandhi, a educator, activist, and journalist here in Portland, and we're going to talk to her today for a few minutes about her background and activities. So tell us, Marlena, how long have you been in Portland?
I came up here in the summer of 1979.
Why did you move to Portland?
I came up here with my future husband.
Just got married and decided
to come up here.
Uh-huh. And I know you from your riding with the rear guard at PSU. How did you get involved at PSU?
I was a student there and was also teaching on social justice movements. And I had some friends who were on staff. They knew of my work and told me to see about coming on as a writer. And I did that for a year.
Okay, and what kind of activities were you involved with before your involvement there with the Rear Guard?
Well, I started out as an activist in the domestic shelter movement, for battered women's shelter movement, and then I also became active with PECUN, which is the Oregon Farm Worker Union.
And how did you find out about them?
I just happened upon a rally that was happening downtown. SEIU was working on organizing some hotel workers, and some of the leadership of PECUN was down there and told me about some of the volunteer positions that were available, and I started doing organizing for them.
And what kind of campaigns were y'all working on there? Was that with SEIU or is that PECUN?
No, this is something separate. We work in coalition with SEIU and a lot of other labor unions.
Who is we?
PECUN.
Okay.
And I was assigned some tasks in Portland. The first thing that I took over on my own was spearheading the Garden Burger boycott. I had also been active on the NORPAC boycott.
And what were the issues around that campaign?
Well, NORPAC was not allowing its farm workers to organize for a union even when they were having elections. So we tried negotiating with NORPAC for about 7 years, and it was after the seventh year that we just decided to implement a national boycott on their products.
Okay, and is that an ongoing thing, or has they
the boycott? Kind of resolved the boycott was actually rescinded in 1999. Mm-hmm. But NORPAC has still not gone to the table with them.
Mm. Well, that's a travesty. Okay, and with the Rear Guard, you eventually became editor at the newspaper there?
Right. And in a way, that became my form of activism, as I was spending more time at the university and in classes there. I basically moved a little bit away from activism and instead started documenting the movement that I had been part of and other people that were in coalition with labor rights unions and immigrant rights unions. I documented those struggles as well.
And, yeah, and it seems like that was like a few years back that you were working with the Rear Guard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't actually been active at PSU for a few years now, but I've continued writing online, and I've recently been assigned some pieces by the Portland Alliance, which is a progressive paper here in Portland. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing work with them.
So that would that be the extent of your current activity? What else do you have going on these days? As an activist and a writer.
I'm actually working on a book. I'm interviewing four women who identify as anti-authoritarian or anarchist women of color. And I hope to have that published by the spring. with Eberhardt Press here in Portland.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for your cooperation and consenting to this interview, and we're going to see if we can get this published online.
All right, thanks very much. Thank you for having me.
Robin Marlena spoke with Catherine Higgins of KBCS in Seattle during the Grassroots Media Camp community dinner. They reflected on their experiences in the podcasting workshop.
I just loved the fact that it was so simply demystified, you know, thinking that it was going to take a lot more time and a lot more know-how. And it's really pretty basic.
I was worried that, you know, we'd have to spend huge amounts of money to get all this different equipment, to, you know, mixing boards and microphones and everything else. And then it turns out we just need, you know, the right software for the computer and we're ready to go. And, it's, it really helped a lot to make me, you know, think, you know, I can actually really do this in an immediate sense.
On Saturday, August 25th, after a day of workshops, the community was invited to attend a dinner with enchiladas, tamales, rice and beans, and agua de Jamaica. The dinner was prepared by Las Mujeres de las Brazoletas, a group of women who were arrested during the June 12th immigration raids on Del Monte. The women have organized to support themselves and one another in a time when their families have been torn apart and their futures are uncertain. This is a translation of one of the women speaking at the event.
There are three representatives from the group, the women of the bracelets, here today. We are very thankful to the community because they have helped us and supported us throughout the situation we have been living. We also wanted to show and express from the beginning that we were not just going to depend on the city or the community. We decided to start selling food in churches, and as we've been becoming to be known among the community, your community has called us out to events like this, to be able to raise funds, to be able to cover our expenses of everyday living. The funds from Catholic Charities ran out last month, and there's no longer going to be any rent assistance or bill assistance. And we don't know what we're going to do without that extra help. Many of us are single mothers, and we were depending on that assistance to get by. Among the many things we're doing is a documentary that will show every part of our situation, from the time we came to this country, where we came from, our working lives, and the raid. We're also thinking of writing a book to put the depression and the situation we have lived in print. It's been incredibly difficult since the moment that immigration detained us. The majority of the women in our group have entered a deep depression. The majority of women are going to choose voluntary deportation because there is not another option. And the few of us who have the chance of following up with our case, the cost is incredible. For my case specifically, it would come to $10,000 to $15,000. Since we've only been able to live from day to day, we are trying to come up with some seed money to send with the women who choose voluntary deportation. We thank you for your support. We will continue struggling as long as we're in this country. And the kids, whether they were born here or in Mexico, it's the same thing. We know they will not have the same opportunities as they had here once we return to Mexico. It's difficult to think of what will happen to them. On behalf of the women who were here and the women who were not here but helped make this food, we thank you.
You're listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7, and we've been listening to media recorded at the Portland Grassroots Media Camp that took place in late August. Now we bring you an interview with P.C. Perry, who is one of the workshop facilitators at the Portland Grassroots Media Camp.
P.C. Perry is my name. Flying Focus Video Collective is part of what I do. And for Flying Focus Video Collective, I do the field coaching. We started the first Gulf War, so they call it. I call it the massacre in the Middle East. And we started documenting what was going on in terms of protests and actions that were taking place, and there was a need for coverage of not only speakers and events, but actions. So we've been doing that now for about 15 years, and we have some 600 or more shows in the can, so to speak. We use the Portland Community Media, as it's called now. It was called Portland Cable Access when we started. That is used for editing purposes, and at one point we used it for borrowing equipment. But we record things. We do not shoot things. That is a desensitization of people's awareness and allows them to get into actually the massacring of people, not only in the Middle East, but every place on the planet. So we record things or tape things locally, nationally, and internationally, and we distribute locally, nationally, regionally, and internationally. So we use the facilities of Portland Community Media to do that editing, and then we are obliged to then put those shows on their cable access ways.
Is there a regular time slot for Flying Focus?
The easiest one for people to remember is Friday, Channel 11, 9:30 p.m. Others, you should look at the website, flyingfocusvideo.com, and see the other times for it. It's not really airing, but it's showings because it's on cable access. There have been times when those shows would be live, and most times they're taped. And we run between, I'd say, 6 and 52 members, depending upon the action that's to be taken or covered.
6 and 52 members that are involved in Flying Focus?
That's correct.
And is it a collective?
It is a collective, definitely. Depends on who's there and what kind of energy exists at the time as to what we get done.
Are there any paid staff at Flying Focus currently?
None.
Yeah.
We've never had paid staff at Flying Focus, and I doubt we ever will.
How is the work shared? Are there core people that tend to be more involved, or is it just kind of like whoever can do it from time to time? Or?
It's both, actually. The core gets burned out, and others tend to come in and fill the gap occasionally. Sometimes, yes, they do. Sometimes, no, they don't. And when they don't, things pile up. When they do, training has to go on in terms of how has it been done traditionally, what would be great to do as a new way of doing it. So it's always a learning challenge on both sides. And there's never been one answer of how to do it.
Do you train people?
We train people in a number of areas, that is field collecting of information, recording, editing, producing, and office work. That some people like to do, some can't do, but we appreciate the help. In the training for Flying Focus, the stories that we cover are the ones that we just can't bear not to have covered. They might be in town, they might be in another part of the country, or they might be in some other part of the world. We then use equipment that is appropriate for recording that. that's in terms of the level of technology and the vulnerability of the equipment. It might be such that you may not get the camera back. Or it may be that you don't need such high degree of technical equipment, and so we'll record it on low tech. And our idea on low tech is that you should be able to record what's going on and get it out to people, disseminate the information, and that's what's important. I hate to use the reference of Rodney King, but I think most people understand that. It was the person who recorded Rodney King's beating and got that information out that made it important. It wasn't the degree of production quality. You know, you can have great production quality for making diaper ads, but if you can't get it to the people where it's usable, it's not the most important thing. So we try at Flying Focus to use low quality technology, be it VHS, digital 8, high 8, or even the latest is going toward memory cards now, in order to get the acquisition of the material. And once people understand how to do that, then they can make a story from it. So that's the same thing we were trying to do in the grassroots media camp, is to show people what the equipment is, how you can capture what's going on in the field, and then get that information to people who can use that information. You might have people who are just needing to know what's going on around them. You might have activists who need to know what other activists are doing. Many people need to be in touch with visionaries, so we're trying to get that information out to as many people as possible. Low cost is the primary interest because we just don't have any money. Extremely, extremely low budget.
PC talks about the workshops that he facilitated at the camp.
The two workshops that I did, and they wound up being three, the first was field video. That involved cameras. So that's cameras in the field, and what are those cameras? What do you do with them? What do you need as basics? The other one was audio in the field for video. Now I say for video because there were other workshops that were audio for radio, and they were a little different emphasis. So in the first one, field camera, I think... Actually, probably both workshops, I wound up bringing about 10 or 12 bags worth of equipment. So people could see the range of equipment that has existed and is still usable, get a chance to put their hands on it, to see how it works, why it works, and most properly, how to select what you need for either an interview, a speaker, or an event that you have no idea what it's going to be before you get there. So what are your tools that you need to take to make sure you can get the information? So that was mainly it for camera and in the field. For audio in the field for video, our primary emphasis was on knowing the difference between microphones, understanding what close miking entails, and being able to position and select properly which microphones and how to get the best audio for it. They were both good classes, and I guess maybe I should throw in the third class that occurred. On Saturday, we did the camera in the field. That was, let's say, in the morning. The next class that occurred was Tyrone Hines doing his class on oral histories. So his emphasis was on recording, and since I had just done one on video, I gave some of the remaining attendees to use the camera to capture what was going on in his class. But at the same time, Tyrone and I shared information on how you can effectively capture what's going on during an oral history. So that was great. A little bit exhausting because I hadn't intended to stay that long, but adrenaline gets you over more things than you need to. The three classes turned out to be just great because they were so diverse in attendance. I won't say they were so diverse in color because we did not have attendees of color of African or African-American descent. We did have Brazilian, Japanese, Euro-American, Mexicano, El Salvadoran, and folks from Seattle, folks from Portland. And the men and women, I think, was a pretty good balance. So it was good to have that kind of diversity because the questions coming from the attendees were quite varied. So you had to get information out to satisfy what their intent of using video and audio happened to be. And it required a lot of thinking on your feet, which is what you have to do anyway when you go out in the field.
Regarding attendance from the African-American community, what has been your experience in Portland as far as doing trainings for video in the African-American community? And if you have ideas on, you know, how grassroots media might do better outreach within that community?
Well, you know, I just did a couple of interviews with Native American leaders on a topic that taught me some interesting things from a different perspective. One important thing is that if you want to have involvement from a community not your own, it's best to go help other people in their areas of need when they need it, not just when you want to have their presence noted and identified. That's too late. You can't call on people and say, "Oh, we don't have any black people, or we don't have any women, let's go find some." Everybody's quite aware of that, and nobody's interested in that. So that's the one main thing. The other is that I guess we were a little naive in Flying Focus, and we've since learned over the years, because we started on some pretty grassroots topics and learned that as we hoped we would be able to put the equipment in the hands of many people without money, and we would give that information for free. The only thing we wanted back was their continued sustaining energy to keep us able to give access to them and for us to continue to be in existence. We didn't really understand that even if you get the equipment for free, people have to be able to sustain themselves. It was nice to have a young woman who wanted very passionately to do work with Flying Focus try to do that. But when she doesn't have daycare for her children, and she has to either go to work or go to the unemployment office and show up all the time, you just can't expect that people are going to have that kind of energy and resources to be able to do things for free. Those of us who stay with it know that it's a privilege. It also has to be an obsession in order for you to keep doing it. I used to tape on a weekend, three whatevers in a day. And after a couple of years, I had to drop back to two, because I remember going back to my apartment and gathering up some more equipment and changing the equipment and just lying down for a minute and saying, I just can't get up and go do this again. And then a couple of years after that, it dropped down to one event a day. This takes its toll on you to the extent that for about 5 years, I only slept for 2 hours a night. Because I would go to work in the day, was trying to keep a relationship going, an elder mother that I was trying to take care of with Alzheimer's. Not Alzheimer's, but dementia, it might as well have been the same thing. And refused to be an automaton and go to work and just go to sleep and get up and go to work again. I had to do this work of organizing to the extent of using video as a tool for social change is what Flying Focus is based in. With that kind of commitment, you really don't have time to even realize that it's taking a toll on you. To the extent it cost me a lot of memory loss, short-term memory loss, and you don't realize it until it's way too late.
So do you have ideas from that experience about how activists that are driven and passionate and obsessed with this kind of work and want to do good work in the world can do it in a sustainable way?
Yeah, I actually learned from my mother in taking care of her. You know, I wanted to and felt I had to, and it wasn't so much I felt I had to, it felt like there was no choice but to do anything other than take care of her in the areas that were most demanding for her and for myself. And I was constantly reminded by staff in the care field that you have to take care of yourself in order to take care of somebody else. And that finally filtered over into my obsession with recording and documenting things. I didn't realize in the beginning how important and necessary that is, but it is absolutely necessary. You may think it's selfish, but there are different understandings or interpretation of selfish. You can't help a drowning person unless you know how to swim. So activists, organizers have to keep a, it's called that touchy-feely thing of being grounded, but if you can't be grounded and understand how to place limits on what you're doing, you're not going to be able to help anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Part of the purpose of the Grassroots Media Camp was also to try to network folks so that they did realize that they're not alone in mm-hmm. doing this and that there are resources and support and that we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. And I'm kind of interested on, because you've been a longtime media activist, have you seen attempts at this type of networking before? And what do you see as the future of grassroots media as a more connected group of people here in Portland?
This is going to be a little bit of a circuitous answer, but this is something we've been thinking about for years and something I even had discussion on Friday with Patrick Angstrom-Poor and about 10 minutes ago with Tim over at the City Bikes referenced this very subject. So what we've all come to see over the years is that, first of all, we're living in a college town. And that's good because you have people who question and you have people who will dare to struggle in order to win. The short side of that is that they don't stay around very long. And so you train people and you train people and you train people. And they stay for 6 months, maybe a year, maybe even 2 years. But after that, either their income changes or their profession changes or they graduate or, you know, they feel like they've had enough of whatever they're doing. Let's go for a change. And then you start all over again. But you're putting the energy out, and so the good part of that is that you have a lot of people over the years out there who are capable of doing the collection and dissemination of information and being visionaries and getting out the ideas of visionaries. The hard part is what's the model for keeping it going? I think there can be no one model. I think all those options of getting the job done need to be tried, and they'll continue on different levels. There is no one answer. We at Flying Focus have always had the interest in training not only people who come through Flying Focus, but Flying Focus going out to other communities and training those members of the community, in whatever community they are, to be able to do the work that they need for themselves and for other people, not just through Flying Focus.
Did you meet anyone through the camp that you might collaborate more with?
Well, actually, I'll probably collaborate a lot more with Tyrone. I saw a piece that he did. It was on a 102-year-old man, maybe 103. He did a very short oral history. He learned video. Tyrone is very fast in learning things, and he's far more intelligent than people realize. So I just shout that out to him. And I have wanted to do more oral histories myself just because I find them so fascinating. They don't necessarily fit into the pattern of what we do at Flying Focus, so I don't do them. But I would like to do them more with him. There was a couple that came from Seattle. She's a journalist, has done documentaries. He's a graphic artist and helps her. I was able to, I think, get some basic information across to them about how to use the camera and how to use the camera's audio to capture information. She knows about the structure of what to do after it's captured. I believe I'm going to be more in touch with them to find out how to more effectively structure a story for different recipients, and we'll share information that way. So I think there will be probably more people that I'll be in touch with that way. Mm-hmm. Others I may not be in touch with because I think they'll be traveling. I'll just reiterate a couple of points. One is that there's no one way to do anything. Stay open to things that you have not ever done before. There's a song out called Listen to Women for a Change. It's a double entendre. And I have to say, listen to youth for a way. The different ways in the last couple years that I've been learning to do things in a different way and to do different things has come in those two avenues, working more with women and working more with youth. You learn not to speak the same language, to use the same equipment, to use it the same way, and you wind up giving out a different message. And it's definitely a learning experience both ways. Mm-hmm. So teachers aren't only speaking, they have to learn to listen.
You've been listening to Circle A Radio. If you'd like to get involved or find out what's happening with the Portland Grassroots Media Camp in the future, contact BolivarianMedia@gmail.com. That's BOLIVARINMEDIA @gmail.com. All right, keep your pencil handy. Here are some of the options for learning low or no-cost media skills in Portland. Want to learn video production? Portland Community Media offers a certification program. The first step is to attend a free 90-minute orientation session. Advanced sign-up is required, and those interested should contact Community Relations Specialist Pam Karsten at 503-288-1515, extension 112. Reservations are taken starting 30 days before each orientation date. The next session is Sunday, October 20th at 6 p.m. More information is available at www.pcmtv.org. You can get in touch with the Flying Focus Video Collective by contacting them at 503-239-7456, that's their office, or 503-321-5051, that's a voicemail, or by email at ffvc@flyingfocus.org. You can find out about Portland's queer-friendly video collective at myspace.com/pdxgayvclub. KBOO Community Radio offers a variety of free classes for volunteers. To learn more about getting involved with KBOO, email volunteer coordinator Ani Haynes at volunteer@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032 for more details. The Independent Publishing Resource Center is on the web at www.iprc.org. Check out their upcoming classes. Portland Free School, free classes around Portland and not just about media, can be found at portlandfreeschool.org. That's portland.freeschool.org. Circle A Radio broadcasts every first and third Wednesday at 6 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 Community Radio. You can contact us at circlearadio@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.